Okay, let's talk to Craig Bolanos then, the co-founder and wealth advisor at Vest Gen Wealth Partners. Their new website is GetRetiredStayRetired.com. Hi, Craig.
John, great to be with you, and how wonderful it is to see the Dow up 600 points after a week of tariff chaos.
Well, that's the glasses one quarter full. I'm happy that you're optimistic. What's that all about?
Well, I am optimistic because so far the sentiment, how we all feel, is terrible. I was reminded of that again in the University of Michigan Consumer Sentiment Survey. But while the feelings are bad, and how can they not with the ping pong ball being batted back and forth so quickly, the data is still good. And if we're going to make decisions that are repeatable, data-driven decisions is where people should be. This doesn't look like a recession. This is just a correction in the stock market.
It's interesting because the reason that the market went down, though, wasn't fear over a continuing resolution. It was over tariff wars and other unpredictable things out of the administration that we may have a budget now, to me, doesn't fix all of the other things that have caused the market to go down. You see what I'm saying?
Well, no, it doesn't fit. I mean, listen, let's look at the positives, though, this week, because the positives are just overshadowed by policy chaos on trade. I mean, earlier this week, we got the consumer price index, and guess what? It went lower. Thank you. I'm happy about that. The very next day, we got the producer price index. That's wholesale prices versus consumers that are retail, and it didn't grow. And if the inflation can come down, that means the Federal Reserve can give us those rate cuts we want later this year. And then people, as you and I talked about just the other week, we start trading bunk beds for bedrooms, and that'll be wonderful. And I've got another list of positives. You just mentioned one. We got the bill out of the House. It's sitting in the Senate. They're going to vote. I think this is going to pass, and we're going to avoid a government shutdown.
How do these trade policies not raise inflation?
Well, you know what? Right now, the needle is bouncing back and forth so much that everybody knows. I've been on your show. I like free markets. I love free men. I like free women. I don't love all of this trade intervention. Certainly, we understand that when you put tariffs on things, it's going to cost people more money. I mean, I jokingly said I'm worried about getting margaritas and other things that come from Mexico. I mean, who doesn't like a good chip and guac on a Friday to celebrate when the workday is done? That stuff is going to be more expensive based on where we're heading. But because nothing is finalized and nothing is definitive, I'm not spending too much time losing sleep yet.
Well, a lot of people are. So you don't think these tariffs then are going to be true?
I think there is truth in the tariffs. I think what's happened is we don't know what the end goal of the policy chaos is yet, and I don't know where it's going to settle. When I look back at Trump 1.0, I mean, I'm unhappy about what's going on, John. Let me be clear about that. But when I look back on Trump 1.0, that was 2018 and 2019, the tariff or trade war with China, looking back at it, it ended up being good because we ended up onshoring components into the United States. We ended up nearshoring components to the United States, and we were being taken advantage of. This one is so chaotic because it's not just us in one country. It's us in Canada, us in Mexico, us in everybody. And no, I don't know where it's going to end.
And what's the sense of the Canada thing?
You know, I've never seen anything as crazy as I saw this week. You had that post on Truth Social by the president saying we're going to double the tariffs on steel and aluminum to 50% on midnight. And then in response to that, an hour later, you had Ontario call America and say we're going to jack the price on electricity, which would adversely affect three states in the continental U.S. And then 2 hours and 40 minutes later, everyone walked everything back, both in the U.S. and Canada. Yeah. So where are the grown-ups in the room, John?
Well, I must tell you, I don't care if they do that. Maybe that's the way these things go. That might be the way you and I negotiate the cost of a used car. Oh, yeah, well, I'll give you this. Well, you give me that. Well, then what about this? No, that thing's no good. All right, I'm going to do this. I don't want them to do that with the world's economy and my savings in public. Do it behind closed doors. It's not that they're doing it. It's that everybody's watching them do that. If they ultimately come up with a plan and it makes sense and we're better, hooray for that. But the watching and hearing them make the sausage is so unsettling to the markets. And maybe everything will recover. You know, if we can get 3,500 points back on the Dow this summer, I'll be glad. But you can understand why I'm pessimistic about that right now.
Oh, I understand, because you feel terrible, as do most people feel terrible, that sentiment, because we're watching this unfold publicly as opposed to having it unfold privately. But I think, again, that if we look at a couple of positives, and I'm not trying to see the world through rose-colored glasses, John, I'm just being sincere. When was the last time you saw a recession when we've had 49 consecutive months of job growth? Just did 151,000 jobs last month. When was the last time you saw a recession without widespread earnings cuts? Haven't had that. And when was the last time you saw a recession when the consumer was still spending? We learned last week it was 3% up year over year, and that's adjusted for inflation. And if we get some policy positives, that's tax cuts getting extended, the ongoing deregulation, the CPI and PPI data means the Fed put is still in place. And I have to think, I'll close with this, I don't think that some of the people in the administration, specifically our Treasury Secretary and Secretary of Commerce, which are hedge fund and Wall Street guys, I don't think they want to kamikaze the U.S. economy. They just need to get the president out of our way.
We're talking to Craig Bolanos, and I won't describe his disposition as sunny or rosy. He said he doesn't like necessarily what's happening. He said he doesn't like what's happening in Washington, but he's optimistic about the health of the economy. So when do you think then we'll see the indices recover, Craig, or are you in the prediction business?
John, I don't mind being in the prediction business. I mean, I wouldn't do your show if we didn't have strong opinions. So this is not a bear market. Bear markets tend to have these bottoms, these one-time events where it's baby out with the bathwater, everything gets sold. This is a correction. And in corrections, it's much more of a controlled process. And that controlled process of the correction is we've been hovering plus or minus 5,600 on the S&P. That's that 10% declination. I think we're going to churn sideways now through April 2nd. We'll have some rallies, some fits and starts like we've seen, but we need to get past that April 2nd deadline of reciprocal tariffs in order to really move forward and see where we're going.
It's funny, because I imagine a correction would be somewhat based on fundamentals, and this is not based on the fundamentals at all. This is a self-inflicted wound, and I don't know if that gives me cause to feel good or bad. That is, just as surely as we've shot ourselves in the foot here, so too could, as you said, us get some adults in the room, and we will stop talking this nonsense. We'll figure out what the trade policies are going to be, and then things will recover. But what would give one pause is that, in fact, Donald Trump's going to be president for 4 years. And I don't know that we're going to get that sort of adult behavior that the world economy needs. So I appreciate what you're saying, but you can understand why anybody would be pessimistic right now.
Oh, I do. You have to appreciate, as do I, the negative scenario. It's right for people to feel and want to be more cautious. It's right for people to want to brace for continued volatility. But this negative scenario, the R word, the recession word, it's not a foregone conclusion. And the actual facts on the economy and earnings are hanging on as such. And that's why I think the right strategy for people is to make sure they came into the year with a retirement plan. They have enough money, safe assets, money markets, CDs, treasuries, bond or other type of fixed income assets, and allow themselves to go through the equity process, which is what, if you invest, the fee for investing is really just having to sit through these temporary declines, and that's what this appears to be.
So what are you telling your clients about their money management then?
Here's what I'm telling everybody. I'm telling everybody the reason that we have cash flow reserve accounts, enough money in fixed income, treasuries, and high-yield money markets to cover our monthly income is exactly for times like this. Because once you get retired and stay retired, capital preservation matters for that part of the money that you're going to spend for the foreseeable future. And then I remind people of why we're investing for income. That's dividends. That's interest payments. It's fantastic. But then I remind everybody that, hey, volatility, and that's what we have now, is like a toll, and it's the price that we pay to generate and compound our wealth over time. So let's not forget what got us here was investing in great companies of America. Let's not abandon that for the next 20 years of our retirement.
But new money going into investments now, would you buy stocks or would you buy bonds?
I would buy what the portfolio needs to accomplish its objective. Yes, I said that. I'm not hedging my answer, John. Yeah. If somebody, no, but let's talk about this. John, there are so many people that after 2 years, 2023 and 2024, of just riding the FANG stocks, right, the Magnificent Seven stocks, that's the only thing in their portfolio. This should be a dose of reality for those people who were grossly overweight to technology and technology only. As this market rebounds, I don't know how long it takes to get back to where we were, but those people should be looking to sell off some of those tech stocks into strength and re-diversify. Likewise, if somebody somehow missed the rally of the last 2 years, which is inexcusable, this is a great time to go ahead and pinch yourself and say, gee, I probably ought to take some of the money out of my money market or CD, because you can't hide out at 4% forever. Because I got news. I think interest rates will go down, and hence some people should buy.
But you also, you think this is a buying opportunity right now.
I do. For someone who's a long-term investor, this is a buying opportunity, but it can be a buying opportunity in different places. I mean, number one, think about geography. You and I talked about that geography lesson a couple of weeks ago on your show, John. I mean, you have European stocks, emerging markets that are up. That is a trend that might actually be durable this time. After U.S. markets outperforming from the spring of 2010 all the way through 2024, it might be a sea change. That doesn't mean U.S. stocks have to lose. It just means people should look at their geography and get some dollars invested on the other side of the pond.
And one last thing, you're not real bullish then on tech stocks right now, or is this a good time to go back in?
I think people need to be investing where innovation resides. Because innovation creates disruption, and that's a long-term investable thematic. And that is going to lead you to places like technology. But we also have to accept, so yes, be a buyer of tech, but be a buyer of non-tech. I mean, generative AI isn't just a tech story. It's an everything story. Think of how it's going to transform and improve earnings in non-tech companies like healthcare, industrials, and financials. Yeah. So follow the movement. That's what people should be doing.
That's Craig Bolanos. He's the co-founder and wealth advisor at VestGen Wealth Partners. The website is getretiredstayretired.com. Okay, Craig, really interesting. Thanks for your help today.
Great to be with you, John.
Now we talk with Laura Ellis, the Chief Strategy Officer, Executive Vice President, and President of Residential Sales at Baird and Warner, BairdWarner.com. Hi, Laura. Welcome to the show.
Hi, John. Thanks for having me.
What's your sort of a forecast for this spring? A lot of houses going to sell, or is the market going to be flat? What are you thinking?
Well, we're thinking, it's a bit early, first of all. We've got about 2.5 months in, and it's going to be much the same story as 2024, which is very, very tight inventory. We just don't have enough homes to sell. We have plenty of buyer demand, but we started this year out with about 17% less active inventory on the market than we had a year ago. So, you know, the challenges for buyers are going to be, you know, extremely competitive market continues. Our prices are continuing to appreciate. But again, John, it's early. We have to see what March, you know, brings to bear. We're hearing of a lot of sellers coming onto the market. There's a couple of years of pent-up demand, in my opinion. So we're just watching it very, very closely.
Must be tempting for some of those quote-unquote sellers to sit there. They want to get out of the house. They know they can get a premium price. They just got to find somewhere to live. That's the problem, right?
That is the challenge. You hit the nail on the head there. A lot of lenders out there are working hard to get the word out. And we have a mortgage company here at Baird & Warner, Key Mortgage, and they're trying to get the word out that there's all kinds of creative financing becoming more and more apparent for sellers in that situation where they could leverage the equity in their home in order to purchase the home before selling theirs. Because a huge fear that people had was, I'm going to put my house on the market, it's going to sell immediately, and I'm not going to have somewhere to go. And So we're looking to some of those options as solutions.
What's easier to imagine, the inventory expanding through construction or interest rates coming down?
Well, interest rates, interestingly, did come down a bit this week. They're pretty attractive right now, as you know, comparing to the last couple of years, in the low sixes. And so we're seeing more, a little bit more activity there. Again, buyer demand not really being the issue. What you're bringing up, new construction, that really is the challenge. I heard a statistic recently that nationally we're about 7 million homes behind. In other words, we need to build about 7 million homes to catch up to the demand that's out there right now. So that's going to take a while. It's going to take years for the builders to be able to do that.
And even that is interest sensitive too, right? That is, builders have to borrow money to build homes. If the rates they feel are too high, then unless they have a lot of money in the bank, they're not going to be building like they would if they were borrowing, right?
You're exactly right. And then you throw in uncertainty with what's going on in the world, and you're hearing a lot right now about tariffs and things like that. That all has an impact on the cost of homes and how much risk builders are willing to take right now.
What's making a home attractive right now? Talk about features or amenities or styles. What should sellers be thinking about or buyers be looking for?
Well, it's my view that we've always, you know, the last several years we've had a strong demand for ranch homes. A lot of that has to do with the baby boomer population getting well into retirement years now. People like those ranch-style homes. They don't have to struggle with the stairs. Things that are continuing to be in demand are an extra bedroom or designated in-home office space. A lot of people still are working from home a day or two a week. So things like that are very attractive. I've been in the real estate business for a long time, and for most of my career, swimming pools were not an attractor. But since COVID, now they are. Buyers are liking to see those. We're still seeing that play out. And also, really, homes that are in move-in condition, those are the ones that are going to sell very quickly and for likely in the Chicagoland area over list price.
Laura, can you talk about the finish that thought. I have another question, but go ahead.
Oh, what I was going to say, but due to the lack of inventory being very tight, your house certainly does not have to be perfect to go on the market and get a buyer today. Yeah. It's a supply and demand issue.
Yeah. Well, talk about the rules that have come into play now with the change. How impactful has that been? Has that been stressful for the buyers and sellers and agents? What's it like out there?
Actually, it has really calmed down from a year ago when we were first grappling as an industry with how are we going to explain these changes to buyers and to sellers? Mm-hmm. And is this going to have, you know, a significant impact on people wanting to move forward? What we're seeing right now is that buyers still overwhelmingly want representation. Sellers want representation. As long as the real estate professional is able to articulate their value and explain those things, buyers and sellers are very content in moving forward. It's our view here that this has actually been a positive change for the industry because it's brought a new level of transparency to both buyers and sellers, to how the process works, who's paying the commission, how the commission is paid. One of the fears that was out there primarily among buyers was, oh my goodness, I have to save up this money for this down payment, and now I'm going to have to save up additional money to pay my agent. Well, the reality is the majority, I would estimate well over 99% of all commissions are still being paid through the transaction. So what I'm saying is that a buyer is asking a seller to pay their agent, and the sellers are overwhelmingly agreeing to do that. So fundamentally, bottom line, financially, it has not impacted buyers and sellers. And the benefits is that there's just a whole new level of transparency and understanding from both buyers and sellers. So it's definitely calmed down. Your agents who do significant amount of business, they've done this time and time again already since the changes went into effect last August 17th. And they're pretty well versed and skilled in that. As long as they're able to explain it to the buyers at the very beginning, we're having pretty smooth transactions.
What would you say the percent is of total commission? It used to be 6, but I think people knew to ask for 5. Is it 5? Is it less now because of this transparency, or where is that, would you say?
Well, what I'd have to say is due to the transparency, and it's in the agreements that the commissions are negotiable between the buyer and their agent and the buyer and the seller and their agent. So that is explained verbally. It's explained in writing. Now, I can only speak for my company, but we have not seen a change in the commissions. So the commissions that are being paid are pretty consistent with what they have been. There were some predictions that commissions were going to plummet and buyers were not going to be willing to pay it and so forth. And we've just not seen that.
I wondered if this was going to happen, that since it's all on the table now, maybe it's more comfortable for some buyers to say, this is a $400,000 house. I'll give you $5,000 to, or maybe the seller. But either way, I just wondered if rather than as a percent, people would value maybe the time or some other factor and just say, you know what, for this house, I don't think I should have to spend more than $5,000 or $10,000 to sell it. I wonder if they would come with a number rather than a percentage.
Yeah, we're watching this very closely because it's still early. You know, since the changes went into effect in August and we started working with clients in a more transparent manner, those transactions in August were closing in October, November, and now we're just going into a spring market. So we're watching it very closely. To date, we have not experienced that. As far as I know, as an industry, and certainly here at Baird & Warner, we haven't experienced that. But that doesn't mean that's not in the future. You know, we're in an industry that is evolving very, very quickly right now. So we are watching those things very closely, and I'll be happy to report back to you next time when we have an opportunity.
Well, we would love to have you back. Any last thought from you then, Laura?
My closing thoughts would really be to buyers and sellers to understand the market, make sure you're working with a knowledgeable professional. Buyers, it's still going to be a competitive situation for you. Make sure you've got good guidance. You have your financing all in place. To sellers out there, you really may not be helping yourselves by delaying and putting off a move, especially if your lifestyle and your desires and your goals are important to you. If your home continues to appreciate, so will the next home that you buy. And so, you know, a lot of times people, and we're getting that a lot lately, John, people will call us and say, what should I do? This is my life plan. Should I wait? Should I go? So my advice is really to talk to a knowledgeable real estate professional and get good advice through them.
Laura Ellis is a chief strategy officer over at Baird & Warner, BairdWarner.com. Really helpful today, Laura. We'll call you again.
Thank you, John. Have a great day.
More business news on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Here's Steve Grzanich.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. Chicago's getting another popular chicken chain restaurant. Cranes reports Crimson Coward, which specializes in Nashville-style hot fried chicken, is opening a location in the Loop. The chain will open on the ground floor at 328 North Michigan. Crimson Coward is based in Los Angeles. The company boasts all-natural, non-GMO chicken that's free of hormones and antibiotics. Highlights of the menu include a fried chicken sandwich, chicken and waffles, and a burrito with the featured chicken wrapped in a tortilla. Planning is moving forward for a boutique hotel in Chicago's Lakeview neighborhood that would cater to the LGBTQ plus community. Developers are focused on a plot of land at 3257 North Halsted. That's where Yoshi's Cafe was located before it closed back in 2021. Right now, the plans call for a 51-room hotel, and the building will have a rainbow-striped facade. The hotel will feature a restaurant, speakeasy-type lounge, and a rooftop pool. Construction should start next year. I'm Steve Grzanich, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
Steve Alexander is back with the business of food.
Yeah, thank you. And if you've ever thought about going into the grocery store business, not many people do. It's a very competitive business with very thin margins. But there is an opportunity to invest in a grocery store right now in Lombard. Not like a Jewel, though. This is a food co-op.
Basically, full-service grocery stores, but they focus on selling as much locally, sustainably produced food as possible.
That's Jerry Nash, a board member of Prairie Foods in Lombard, which is not open yet, but it's getting closer and would be
the first food co-op in DuPage County.
And this is how it works, where you can be an owner.
The idea behind the co-op is that we have owners that are members of our community, and therefore our community is invested in the success of our store, but we are also there for the community. So everyone can shop there. We just get, owners get perks. They get benefits when they shop and have a say in their grocery store, have a say in what we're selling.
That's Leslie Carey, another board member of the Prairie Co-op in Lombard, and only $200 gets you in the door of ownership. More from her and Jerry and how you can invest. After I thank the Chevy Silverado for sponsoring us today, there's never been a better time to put a Silverado in your toolbox. Find out how at ChevyDrivesChicago.com. The community is what's driving Lombard's first food co-op.
Yeah, community engagement and community involvement. That's what we're all about, but we also need the community to really support what we do. That way we're all together, we are stronger together, and we all support the same mission at the same time.
And it's been in the works for a long time.
We've been organizing for 12 years.
But now, with 2,100 investors, they raised enough money for a store. It's in the Eastgate Shopping Center, right next to Ace Hardware. Not open yet, though. They're under construction and making a final push for $400,000 more in donations to get the doors open and keep them open.
We're actually being very responsible so that we don't open and then get perhaps lower sales than we thought, and then we have to close. We want to build up a cushion for after we open.
You can find out more about the Lombard Co-op at prairiefood.coop. On the food calendar, it's National Potato Chip Day, and it's 314, so it's National Pie Day. I'm Steve Alexander. Cherry for me. That's the business of food on 720 WGN.
Trevor Wegener is here, chief economist of the Computer and Communications Industry Association. Hey, Trevor, you're on WGN. Hi.
Hi, thanks for having me.
The businesses you represent, just tell me who your team is.
We represent many of the leading U.S. Technology companies, including many of the household names that you know, as well as many smaller tech companies as well.
You say there haven't been the sort of purchases of startups that we should be seeing right now. Why is that?
So since 2021, federal antitrust regulators have been making it much more difficult for large companies to acquire startups or really to merge or acquire with anyone. They filed more antitrust cases in the past few years than they have in the 20 years prior. And they've really tried to create this process as the punishment enforcement norm, which has really led to a situation in which acquisitions by larger companies have pretty much declined. Leading tech companies used to buy dozens of startups a year, and they've nearly stopped altogether. They just acquired three startups in 2022 and 2023, and zero in the first half of 2024.
Are you mostly talking about AI startups, companies that are using artificial intelligence in some way?
Those represent about one third of the recent startups that have been receiving any venture capital funding. So when you think about sort of the startup ecosystem in the past few years, about one third of the startup ecosystem is AI companies. You really can't separate them apart. Whatever is affecting the startup ecosystem is affecting the AI ecosystem, because the AI ecosystem represents such a large share of the startup ecosystem.
I understand how antitrust the previous administration was, but don't you have more fertile ground right now with the Trump administration?
So that remains to be seen. There's hope that there will be some favorable movement in the current administration. But as of yet, it's difficult to say that there has been actual movement. And, you know, the negative effects are continuing until there is a favorable movement. Acquisitions of small startups worth less than $50 million have dropped by more than 60%. And acquisitions are the main way that these smaller startups provide earnings to investors like venture capitalists, because these startups worth less than $50 million usually can't go public via an IPO, just because the fixed costs of being a public company are too high for smaller companies to go public. So the removal of the acquisition exit opportunity is really limiting their potential. Unless they can grow to a much larger size, they're unlikely to be able to return any returns to their investors.
Yeah. And with interest rates high, maybe they would more favor an angel investor rather than borrowing, even if they could. What's an example of maybe a business that would have been funded or has been in the past that would have trouble getting the funding now?
Certainly. So there are all kinds of startups that normally wouldn't have had that much difficulty getting funding that are starting to have funding problems. And this can be both, you know, true startups that are quite small, as well as companies that are a bit more established but are still on their growth curve. An interesting example here is iRobot, which makes Roombas. In 2024, the aggressive approach to antitrust enforcement prevented Amazon from acquiring iRobot, even though there was a widespread understanding that it was in financial difficulties and might have difficulty continuing as a going concern. And sure enough, just over a year later, iRobot has announced that there are serious doubts that it will continue operations and that stock has crashed. So that's a good example of a company that would have been able to add a great deal of value to an existing company like Amazon that is otherwise very likely to face cessation of operations unless there's a rapid turnaround.
We have to end this conversation now, but you're saying Roomba, the people that make Roombas, might not be able to afford to make them anymore?
That is a serious concern. iRobot's long-term survival has been in doubt for a while, and they just announced that they're having serious difficulties. And the failure of Amazon being able to acquire them due to these aggressive antitrust actions appears to have sort of solidified that negative outcome.
Hence the concern of your association. That's Trevor Wegener, the chief economist of the Computer and Communications Industry Association. I'm glad you're doing what you're doing. We'll continue to watch this. Thank you, Trevor.
Thank you for having me.